I'm surrounded by clowns on my left and my right. They're not here for the circus. They're here for a clown convention. And none of what you are hearing has been scripted. I'm Gina Kaufman, and since there is a clown convention happening here in town, KCUR Central Standard is going to get to know the city's clown community. And yes, there really is a clown community here in Kansas City. But we'll get to that. Let's start with the clowns right here in the room. Dennis Porter, certified smile maker. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Bravo.
Thanks for letting us be here.
Thanks for coming. I don't talk to clowns every day.
I do, because I talk to myself.
It's good that you can admit that.
Yes.
Terry DeVolt of DeVolt Productions and formerly with the Ringling Brothers. So happy to have you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Beth Bird-Lonsky,
yes,
independent clown, mime, instructor of both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, so I want each of you to give me your personal definition of the word clown, because I know a lot of our listeners are picturing that I'm maybe sitting here with three people who each have on like a rainbow wig, a big painted smile, and a red nose, and one of you is clown. Close. But otherwise, no. That is a clown, but clowns are more than that. So definitions.
Definitions. You know, clowns are physical comedians. Comedians, stand-up comics, do verbal comedy. Clowns will do verbal comedy, but they'll also do slapstick physical comedy. When I do workshops, teach at clown conventions, clown schools, I also always ask students, give me synonyms for clowns, and it's never failed. They'll give me jester, they'll give me all kinds of things, but my favorite synonym and the thing that I try to impress upon everybody is a clown should be an entertainer. Mm-hmm. That is what a clown is.
Beth?
Just one word keeps coming up with on top of your definition to add to that. Mirth maker.
Mirth.
Mirth. Mm-hmm. Mirth maker. Someone who allows you to have fun for yourself. And it is, we are there, we are servants. We're there for the community. We're not there for our own, necessarily for ourselves. It's very selfless.
Why do we need help having fun? That seems like it should be easy.
You think it would be. You think it would be easy.
In this stress-filled day and age?
Right. We are the ones who give you permission. When you see us in our costume and makeup, the area around us, we are allowing you to have fun. So you're safe to do that around us.
So, okay, I'm going to get a third definition in a second, but so far, I mean, we have that a clown is a comedian who performs physical comedy, mm-hmm, and is an entertainer. And to me, then, I think that someone like Adam Sandler, mm-hmm, is basically a clown.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Red Skelton was a clown.
Well, we're going to get to him.
Dick Van Dyke.
Bill Murray.
Bill Murray. Yes, correct. A clown at heart.
Gracie Allen.
Right. Yes. So people do not have to wear clown, the traditional rainbow wig for the bad amateur clowns, and noses and makeup.
Right.
They can just be a physical clown.
And Beth, I mean, yeah, your definition makes me think, I mean, in every group of friends, there's that person who shows up and it might kind of make him or herself into the butt of the joke, but is right, that person who gives you permission to have fun. And so would you say, yeah, that just that does a clown need to be on stage, or is a clown kind of a social role?
It can be a social role. And it feels that way when when I go to parties, I have to check in and go, okay, who did they invite? You know, Beth, or are they expecting me to be this on person that's on? But my friends, you know, it goes back and forth. So, yeah, I hope I'm answering your question. So you are, it's a social thing. I think we need that permission. The person that's like, they are the person that goes, that's the reminder that we can have fun.
And so, Dennis, what about you? Is there anything you would add to these definitions of clown?
Well, along those same lines, I am almost always clowning, even though, mm-hmm, I seldom have clown makeup on, right, nowadays, because I do such a variety of different things.
Though you do have on fluorescent colors.
Currently today, yes. Yeah, you know. So that helps, you know, and when I'm out entertaining, I like to stand out a little bit. Mm-hmm. So even Saturday was a farmer all day.
And he was outstanding in his field.
Exactly.
Oh, and so that was what you were doing for your job. That was not a character you were performing.
Yeah. Well, no, I was there to entertain.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
As a farmer on the farm.
I see. Okay.
So, but I, you know, I want to make sure that people go, oh, he's not just here as a part of this festival as a paid attendee. He's here to entertain me. So a little something that throws it off and is different, lets them know, oh, that guy's got a yellow nose on. He must not just be wandering around the festival.
Okay, wait. So explain to me what it was exactly that you were doing. Explain the shtick from this weekend.
Well, it was actually at the National Ag Hall of Fame out in Bonner Springs. They had their annual Barnyard Babies. And I had a couple times I did storytelling. And the rest of the time, I just strolled throughout the area and entertained people.
And you were dressed how? Other than you have on a yellow nose, but what else?
At the time, since I was a farmer, you know, I had my overalls, plaid shirt, you know, farmer hat, except when it went off. And then you can see I have yellow hair. So that kind of says, he's a little different. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was doing things.
Like what?
Instead of flying a kite, because they had the big kites out in the field, I didn't have a kite because I lost my kite. I just had a tail that I was flying around. Or I had a ring. It's a juggling ring, so it's not very big. But, you know, you toss it on the ground. Go, careful, there's a hole there. Don't step in the hole. Don't want you to fall.
How did people react to that?
Ba-dum-boom.
Yeah. Sometimes shocked, sometimes like, I don't know. And usually the kids went and stepped in the hole. Mm-hmm. And then you go, you must be a golfer. You're a hole-in-one.
Bada-bing, bada-boom.
So it's more about the character and the, you know, actions that you do. And that's what I say is, for my kind of definition, is that I'm very fortunate that no matter how long I get to meet you, may that be a couple of seconds in a parade, maybe that's 5 minutes at a festival or an hour at a birthday party or something, I get to let you forget about the world, good or bad, and just enjoy that moment, have some fun, laugh, smile, and just be in the moment at the time and enjoy life to the fullest.
Being in the moment.
Okay, well, you know, we're here because of a clown convention, and I think the idea of a clown convention maybe kind of makes people laugh. And
good, we've already done our job. Yay!
We can go home now. That's
but
right.
Like, conventions sound so serious and businesslike and important, and I wonder if you think that clowns are important, if you think that clowns should be taken seriously.
Oh, very, yes. Very much. Yeah. We almost, every time there's any kind of a convention or get together, there's probably at least one workshop that's the business side of clowning, which there is, or that clown business is serious.
Well, why should clowns be taken seriously?
I think our job, there are times in history when you look back and you know you need the country or the world needed to be entertained at our lowest time. And that's when human beings rise up to find humor in the worst. And that's how we know we're human.
Yeah, and they should always be taken seriously when they're in Congress, because those clowns are just... just saying.
But being compared to politicians is the lowest of the low, sir.
That's right. That's exactly right. But you know, Gina, here's another thing. We take the business of clowning and comedy and humor seriously. Mm-hmm. So that might be where you're thinking, like a lot of people, we don't care maybe if... the world, they don't have to take us seriously. We want them to laugh, but we take our business of clowning seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, we've spent our lives doing this.
Well, let's hear those stories. Beth, right. I mean, I've heard your story about realizing you were a clown. Mm-hmm. And the way you tell it, it's practically a coming out story.
Oh,
like, like you knew deep down, but couldn't quite admit it even to yourself. What had been your earliest signs that maybe you were a clown? And how did you manage to ignore them at first?
I guess it wasn't so much ignoring them. I didn't even know that they were a possibility.
What do you mean by that?
I was so young. Actually, I'm very fortunate. I knew I wouldn't be a clown when I was 7 because of Red Skelton. And he was on television. So anybody that's younger, please look up Red Skelton.
Well, actually, Beth.
Yes.
We're going to make sure. We have a little clip. This
Thank
is
you.
A moment from one of his comedy routines.
Okay, great.
Well, we were out driving. Hey, I don't know who laid out these freeways in Canada. But you got to be proud of him over at the asylum. I'll tell you that. Well, you get on one of them things you want to get off, you better be in the right lane at the right time, make the right. It happened to me. Of course, I didn't mind. I'd never been to Kansas City before, anyhow. Anyhow, we're driving, see, and we go into this gas station. You know what I can't understand about a gas station? The cash box is out in the open, the office is out in the open, and they lock the restrooms.
Beth, who was Red Skelton?
Okay, he was my grandfather. Just kidding. Mentally, in my heart, he was my grandfather. So I would not go to bed till I got to watch Red Skelton, and my parents just gave up on that, you know. So whenever he was on, it's like, well, she'll go to bed right after. And he was everything to me. I didn't even know it till later. You see pictures of me in a diaper, and I'm mugging into the camera as Clem Cadiddlehopper. I've got it somewhere. And so I would actually, you know, go around imitating him and not know that I was imitating somebody. So you never know who you are when you're on television, who you are for others. So
you saw famous clowns,
yes,
on television and mm-hmm. just started taking on their characters from the time you were young.
Exactly.
This all came to a head when you actually met Red Skelton. Tell That's the story true. Of the night you met him. You were right. a waitress okay. at the time, right?
That's right. This guy right here is
Terry.
Actually, Terry's also in this story. That's how we met. We didn't even know each other at the time. Okay, so it's 85, 86.
Yeah, 1985, September.
1985. So I had just gotten to town. I was 20 years old. I'll try to tell this pretty quickly. So I was working a good bazillion jobs down in Westport, and I couldn't get the night off to go see Red Skelton, and I was brokenhearted. And so a friend of mine, we tried all these different places. We wound up at Gates Barbecue as it was supposed to happen. This is the Gates that's been torn down.
47th and Paseo.
Right, 47th and Paseo, and it had that big glass wall. Well, this is how much I wanted to go. I was delusional. It was late at night, and there's a room full of clowns.
Wait, why were you delusional?
Because I was working too much, doing everything other than what I really wanted to be doing, and that'll drive you crazy. And I really wanted to be performing. And so as I was walking up to the Gates Barbecue building and I saw this room full of clowns, I thought I was hallucinating.
And she's serious, like clown makeup, Ringling Brothers clowns.
Yeah, they were told... were told to be dressed up, and you can tell them how upset Red Skelton was about that. And then I'm walking up, and I didn't say a thing. I'm like, my mouth is open, like, da, 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 da. And my friend goes,
nothing happened.
Nothing happened here.
Happening
right. here. This is normal. And my friend elbows me and says, don't you see the room full of clowns? I go, oh, you see them too? I literally said that. And I go running into Gates Barbecue, right past the hat, may I help you? And I go running into the room with the clowns. That's all I knew. I saw clowns. And I go in there, and I almost run into Red Skelton, and I just see the watch fob and chain.
Those are characteristics of his costume.
Yeah, his costume, the brown suit. Okay, he still had his brown suit on, or a suit. So he had, he was wearing clothes. Anyway, so he had the watch fob and chain, the unlit stogie, the brown hat, right? And I looked up, and honest to God, his face disappeared into a cloud, like, oh, God. And everything, just like in the movies, you know, where everything goes bow-whoop into the background, everything went back.
Bow-whoop.
Bow-whoop. The greasy wallpaper, everything about Gates went in the background. And all I saw was Red Skelton's face, a cloud. And my mouth was open so long as I was staring up at him because he was tall. I literally thought, I felt my tonsils drying out. My head said, say something, say something. So I said, Mr. Skelton, yes, dear. May I have a hug? That's all I could say. May I have a hug? And he goes, why, sure, honey. And he gives me this great hug. And I'm like, well, you can take me now. I'm happy.
Well, Beth, I want to back up for just a second because I understand that, like, earlier, like before this, you've talked about that you're working, doing a bunch of different things except clowning.
Everything except.
You've talked to me before about, like, you're going to try poetry or...
Right. I was a musician. I played saxophone. I was
Why were you
major.
Trying all of these things?
Because I didn't think there was any money in clowning or something. I didn't know. It's almost like I just didn't think we were allowed to be clowns or something. You know, there was something about the society.
She didn't know it could be a profession.
Right. I didn't know it was a legit thing.
And we're not told we all can.
That we all can. And the thing that is, at a certain point, you... if you either are or you aren't, and and you is or you ain't. And if you are, then you better do it.
So this moment, how does it affect you? I mean, at personally.
At that point, I literally thought, well, that's it. That's all the sign I need. And shortly before that, call it what you will, I had put out a big request, a prayer, whatever, and I said, how do I serve my highest purpose? And within 5 days, I met Red Skelton. Well, if you know who Red Skelton is to me, you know, that's all the sign I needed. And that was it. At that point on, that's all I pursued. And I quickly went on to study with Marcel Marceau right away. Right after that, I started trying to figure out how to create and how to perform. And because Red Skelton had those silent moments in his show, I thought all clowns were great at mime. So that's why I went that direction with it. I just want to say, though, right after the hug, this guy to my right was the guy that interrupted us, and he tapped Red Skelton on the shoulder and said, excuse me, Mr. Skelton, is there a line for this, you hog? And
I'm a pig.
He hogged at my moment. Just kidding. And then, of course, Red Skelton turned around to give you a hug.
Yeah, and what he didn't know, I was wanting to get in line to hug Beth.
Yeah. And we didn't even know each other, but yes. And so it's such a small world. So we're
yeah. Yes. And you know, that's Terry, we're going to get to your story shortly, but Beth, yeah. I mean, you've talked about you went to study with Marcel Marceau.
Right.
What would you say was like the clowning philosophy you learned there?
Oh, golly. Just the generosity. You know, Red Skelton was extremely generous and just humble. Like, we heard his stories about when he met Chaplin. Oh, my gosh.
Charlie Chaplin.
When he met Charlie Chaplin, because Charlie Chaplin was to him what Red Skelton was to me. And you know, I mean, we all have that person that we look up to. And how did they be, you know, that desire? And you see it in somebody else, like, I want that. I want to be that, my own version of that. Because, like, with Red Skelton's big career, you could take so many aspects of it and go, well, I thought I was being Red Skelton when I was doing stand-up comedy. And I've got a friend who's coming into Kansas City this summer, Dean Hatton. He's going to do the silent moments for the Fringe Festival.
When you talk about the silent moments, what are you talking about?
There was a lot of mime. He did these short little mime routines. One is called A Fool and a Feather. He performed for the UN. He did mime for the UN.
But what are the silent moments?
They've got different, like, it's mime. It's mime. He did Fool and a Feather. He did Frying Bacon. He did Playing Tennis. They're just cute little short things.
Like skits without
skits.
Talking.
Yeah.
Just physical.
Eating popcorn.
Yes, having tea. So, yeah.
So these are all, like, physical things that can be acted out.
Comedy.
And it sounds like they're acted out in a particular way. Like, you can learn the trade through these.
Uh-huh. Well, yes. Yeah. And one of my favorite formats that he wrote in, I would call one character, one prop. You know, there's a lot of different ways to write mime, but one of the formats he used the most was just him and one prop. And he would establish his character very quickly, and then he would establish the prop very quickly, or he would become the prop. One of my favorites was him being the flower, the growth of a flower from a seed to full life and to going through a storm and a leaf breaking off and then coming back to life. And yeah.
And that moves you.
That moves me, yeah.
So talk to me a little bit more about yourself as a clown. I mean, what are the surprises? What are the challenges? Beth.
Okay. So I would say it just once again, being in the moment, you've got a full you go out there completely in character. So on the way there, you get in character. So there's not like there's going to be anything wrong. Nothing goes wrong when you're in character. You're in the moment, in character, and you're creating those moments person to person. And there are times where I think of it as kamikaze clowning. You don't know what you're going to encounter till you get there. You can go there with all the props in the world and all this plan, and that's folly. You go out you go out prepared, but then you are just open to the moment. And so, like this summer, I'm going to be downtown a lot with the Art in the Loop project. And look for silly walks, hashtag silly walkways. And yeah, so I don't know what I'm going to do till I get there.
Are all clowns good? I mean, we've talked a little bit about like this positive side of clowning.
Real clowns are good.
Tell me about that.
Okay. If you are out there with evil intent, you are really not a clown. That is one of the definitions of being a true clown. You're there for them. You're not there for you. If you're there to make them laugh at themselves and with you, it's yeah. So it's all about them, not you.
Beth Birdlonsky, mm-hmm. Stay with me, okay?
Okie doke.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear what the other clowns in the room have to say. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm Gina Kaufman, just hanging out with three clowns. They are gearing up for a big clown convention. We just heard from Beth Birdlonsky. Now, I'd like to hear from Terry DeVault. Terry, did you always know you wanted to be a clown?
Yes. People ask me how I got started, and I said, well, I was about two years old, and my mom had me in her arms. She dropped me on my head, and I got up and said, here I am. Let's be a clown.
No, but seriously.
I am serious. My mom still feels bad about it. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, so here's the deal. I used to go to the circus as a kid. I would see the clowns, and I saw in Ringling Brothers Circus, they have a 20-minute pre-show they call Clown Come In. Mm-hmm. So it's for the people being seated, waiting for the show to start, and it's actually a show before the show. And so they have one clown after all these skits that would do what they call the blow-off. He's the last clown in the arena right before the big finale, and he has the featured spot. And I watched that guy. I grew up 50 miles south of here of Kansas City in a little town called Drexel, Missouri. So we didn't know a thing about clowning. There was no place for me to learn about clowning. But I would come to the circus, and I can remember being in Municipal Auditorium and watching this guy take a wooden cigar, but he took a cigar, he had a cane, he had a vest on, and like a derby hat. And he got both sides of the audience cheering against each other. And then his big finale trick was he put the cigar in his mouth, which was, a wooden cigar prop. But then he put his derby hat on top of the cane, the handle of the cane. He took his vest off and he put it around the derby, if this makes sense. So then he lifted up this cane with the derby and the vest on it, put it on the cigar so it's balancing in midair, no hands, and then he knocks the cane away and the hat falls down, the vest falls down, he puts his hands through the vest, the hat lands on top of his head, the cane bounces on the ground one time, he picks it and he goes down to one knee and he takes a bow and the whole place goes crazy. That's when I said, I want to do that. And that guy, I found out his name, I met him, he's an incredible clown named Charlie Fry.
How old were you?
I was actually, when I saw that act, I was 16. And I know that because I was driving, and so I drove up from Drexel to see the circus. And so then I met a clown in Harrisonville, Missouri at the Cass County Fair, and I saw this old guy. He was a tramp clown. And I went to the fair and watched him afterwards. I said, sir, I want to be a clown. He said, what's your name, kid? And he goes, I told him, and his name was Harry Pearson, Happy Harry, the boxcar tramp. And so he said, can you drive? I went, yeah. He goes, what are you doing next Tuesday? I said, I don't know why. He goes, well, I need a driver. I got a show in Lewisburg, and I don't see so good. Can you drive me? And I was like, okay. And so I started going with Harry. So that was great. That's how I got into clowning.
You mentioned tramp clown, and I'm curious about the different types of clowns. Can you tell me about them?
Sure. Generally, there's in the clown world, I guess you could say, in traditional clown world, the circus world, there's a white face clown. European clowns, and it's all white. They'll have a white, maybe skull cap, a white, their neck from the neck up's white. Then they'll highlight their features. That's a white face clown. Then they have what's called an Auguste clown, which is like the most famous clown of all, Lou Jacobs. And he's actually was the first guy, the only guy that was living and honored on a postage stamp in about 1966. He's the guy, the circus clown, that has a real tall dome hat. He was actually before the Bill Murray and everybody in Saturday Night.
Coneheads.
The Coneheads. Thank you. Yeah. And so the Coneheads, that was actually Lou Jacobs, and he had a little bitty hat on top of his head. And stamp collectors would out there go, oh, I know that stamp. And so he was honored. So Lou Jacobs would be an Auguste clown. He has a flesh-based makeup, and then he highlights. And generally, you'll see people like when you talked earlier, the bad impression of a bad clown is somebody with a rainbow wig and what we call like a watermelon smile from ear to ear. But from the outer, if you took the outer edge of your eyebrows and drew a line straight down, that's about as wide as your mouth should be painted if you're a good clown. Hmm. Because what a clown does is to help exaggerate their features. Like when you're in the circus, we played Madison Square Gardens. Well, when you're on the arena floor at Madison Square Gardens and you've got two stories of people and, 18,000 people in the arena, you've got to be able to look up the top row and let them see your eyes get wide, let them see your smile. So it's to help exaggerate your features in a theater. And that's an Auguste clown. And then the last one would be a tramp clown, like Emmett Kelly or Otto Griebling. And then from there, they call character clowns, like a sailor clown. Coco in the 50s was a famous circus clown, and he had painted an anchor on his face, wore a Navy hat.
So where, I mean, you seem to have extensive clowning knowledge in addition to training. Where did you learn all of this?
I ran away from the circus and joined a home. I ran away from home and joined a circus. And so actually I went to Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus Clown College.
Clown College?
Yes, in 1983.
What's Clown College like?
Well, Clown College is where you go to learn to be a circus clown. And it used to be the only way you could get hired on Ringling Brothers Circus. They would have 2,000 to 3,000 people apply every year. They would take 60 people max. 10 weeks later, after you go 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and the last 4 weeks, you'd go 7 days a week to get ready to prepare for the graduation gala performance where they decide who they want to hire. You'd be going nonstop for 10 weeks. 10 weeks later, they'd graduate. You'd graduate, and then they would. In 1983, we started out with 55 people.
You say you'd go nonstop all day doing what?
Clown class. We'd do movement. We'd do gymnastics. We would do dance, stilt walking, unicycling, pie throwing. There's an art to throwing a pie.
Wait, tell me about it, because I may need this.
Well, actually, yes, it's something people should know, because amateurs always want to use whipped cream. Yeah. That's the worst thing to use if you're going to pie somebody. Because think about it. Right. Whipped cream is a milk product. So when it gets on your clothes and everything, milk sours. Right. So, yeah. So you never – pros – never pie somebody with a whipped cream pie. We use actually soap and shaving soap. And you could take a foam can, like this can shaving cream.
So the pie has to be intended for throwing and not for eating.
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, it's not to eat.
Okay.
Yeah, it's definitely for throwing.
And what about, I think about this. I have actually thought about this. I don't know why.
Oh,
but
good.
If you're going to throw a pie, how do you pick it up and catapult it? Because your elbow, it can't just slide down. If your elbow is raised and there's a pie on your hand, it would just slide down.
Exactly. So you're going to take your hand with it parallel to the ground, and then you're going to make a sweeping arc, like an overhand throw maybe. And the truth is, what's interesting, people think about pie throwing like when they had the big vaudeville fights, and the slapstick stuff. Well, they would throw pies, and you're just flinging them into a crowd. But the proper way, the truth is, when you pie somebody like as a clowns, you would take the pie, you would walk up to them, you'd surprise them actually. Say they're reading a paper, and you tap them on the shoulder, they put the paper down, they turn around and look at you. That's when you actually place the pie in her face. So to throw a pie or to pie somebody, you actually take the pie from a parallel to the ground, flatten your hand, like if you're holding a pizza pie dough, and you put it to their face and give it a quarter of a turn. That'll let you pull
to
your
hand. To the face, quarter of a turn. You can heard it here first
right
if you
there.
Want to pie someone. But don't use the one intended for eating. It's got to have soap, not
Barbasol.
Dairy product.
Okay. That's right.
All right, so clearly, you have 10 hours a day of learning this whole range of skills, from unicycling to pie throwing. But it all sounds like in the details, it's one way. But what is the ultimate purpose of all of these skills put together? I mean, what is the purpose of clowning to you?
Well, the purpose of clowning is to make people laugh. That's what it's all I wanted to do. And
nothing bigger, in society?
Well, look at me. I'm a simple guy. I leave the big, educated stuff to other people. No, the truth is actually there's a lot of psychology that goes into clowning and things. Like, for instance, if you're with a little kid, I tell people that you have to know you can in this day and age, because thanks to Stephen King and his famous movie and book and stuff, that people got scared of clowns. Well, that started all.
Which famous movie and book are you talking about?
Is that It?
It.
Oh, I thought we were allowed to mention the actual name.
Yeah. Oh. No.
So clowns really object to this.
Well, no, I don't care. I could care less, because I make people laugh, and then they realize, oh, wait a minute, this guy's funny.
But It by Stephen King, I'm sorry, I can see that people are responding negatively, but this is something that
you're
clowns...
talking about Suzanne in the booth. And she's
scared.
Yeah, we know
the
who you're talking about.
But no, I mean...
No, it's true. Well, that's the trouble. I mean, because he made this, movie
scary
and book
clown
to make it scary. So people jumped on that because, that's just the way it works. But you know what I tell people, and you asked earlier, are there good clowns, bad clowns? There's good radio hosts, and there's bad radio hosts. There's good doctors, there's bad doctors. In every area of life, there's good politicians, there's bad politicians.
But with this whole thing of the idea of the scary clown, how do you, like, when your audience is children, or whether it's a
so
few
here's,
or...
Here's the deal. We can make the difference in a child's life till they're an adult. People don't understand, oh, I'm scared of clowns. Why? I don't know. Well, probably the odds are when they were a little kid, some clown like myself that's 6 foot tall that didn't know came up to him and went, hey, how you doing, little kid? And they were like, oh, this guy's got a big red nose and he's tall and he's scary because he's just jumping in their space. But, or many times we'll have the parents, you can see it, the look in their eyes. They'll shove the kid at you and go, here, I want to take your picture. And I'm like, no, the kid doesn't want it. You look at their eyes, and if their eyes get wide, you stop. Like if I got a little 2.5 foot tall kid and I'm coming towards him, hey, how you doing, buddy? Well, the first thing I'll do is drop down to my knees to get on their level. Next thing I do is I'm watching their eyes. As long as they're smiling and laughing and having a good time, it's fine. I do some what we call stick. Give me five. Give me a high five. Give me medium high five. Boom. I smack my head when they hit me and they're like, ah, that's funny. So they get to beat up on an adult. That's why the kids love it. And so, they don't do that with their parents. It's the other way around. So here's the deal though. When you see a little kid and his eyes get big and his mouth opens up, like you stop, you turn to their older brother and sister, make them laugh, ignore him, and then he starts laughing and joining in.
Well, Dennis Porter, what type of clown are you?
He's hopefully a funny one. Yes.
He was reading my mind. He's not a very funny clown. No, he's hilarious. He's
I've been
great.
A wide variety. I started at age 7, so I'm putting on shows in my living room, for whoever I could. And have always been in theater and gradually got into clowning in high school and took one clown class and went, oh, hey, this is my niche. Mm-hmm. This is where I need to go and look and be funny. And, for a long time, I always thought a lot of people would say, a mask like clown makeup was to hide. You could hide behind it and do whatever. But then I heard someone say it actually magnifies your true self.
Yeah.
And I thought about it and went, you're exactly right.
How does it magnify your true self?
It gives you the freedom to ignore everything you've ever been taught, consciously or subconsciously, and just say, why are you here? Mm-hmm. I'm here to make you laugh and make you smile. Mm-hmm. And I can do that in so many different ways, and I have the freedom to do it, and that's okay. That's okay to do that.
I can tell that you all have good chemistry with each other, and I've noticed just in my time in Kansas City that there does actually seem to be a true clown community here, and you seem to be a pretty young clown, and I'm wondering what it's been like to come up into this clown community and what it's like.
Well, I've actually been clowning for 26 years.
What?
Yeah. He started when he was one.
I look a lot younger than I am, fortunately. It's great because there's a lot of different areas of clown in Kansas City also. And there's the circus clowning, and there's a variety of groups around town. Northland Clown Guild, Alley 217, that's hosting the clown convention this year. There's one south, Clowns of America National, Alley 92, Radiance, and some other ones. And then there's the theater clowning, which Beth really pulls more from that. Stephanie Roberts at UMKC does a lot of fantastic theater clowning. And they're different styles, but they also work off of each other and can learn from each other. And it's just a matter of your situation. Are you in a circus ring? Are you on the street? Are you in a theater? Mm-hmm. And there's so many of those things. And all of those instances, we're still there, as been said, to entertain, make people laugh, enjoy life to the fullest at that time.
Do you have a favorite clowning moment? I mean, like a moment where you realize, like, this is what I'm in it for.
I don't think I have a particular moment I can come over out of hand, but every time I see some kid smile, that's it right there. Every time I make someone laugh, every time I particularly make an adult laugh who I can tell when I walked up said, oh, here's the clown for the kid.
Right.
Yeah. And then I made them laugh and go, oh, wait, this is for everybody.
I would love to thank all of the clowns here today for joining me. Dennis Porter, Terry DeVault, and Beth Birdlonsky. This has been fun and informative.
Yay. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Gina.
All right.
Up next, how fatherhood transformed a local musician. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with musician Greg Wickham. He's best known to Kansas City from a bluegrassy Americana band he used to be in called Had a Call. Now, after a long hiatus, he's back. Here's a song from his new album.
If I left this world today, would you still see me the same way? Would you tear down the walls, forgive all my flaws, if I left this world today?
If you left this world tonight, would it turn your whiskey to wine? Would it make your mistakes nothing but bad breaks if you left this world?
This song is a meditation on what would really matter if your time on this earth were finally up, like game over. Greg Wickham, what does this idea have to do with your return to music after so many years?
Well, I think it's really rooted in the change in perspective that I've had as a songwriter. I was out of the game for 15 years, and in that 15 years, I got married. I had three children, and life is very different now than when Had a Call was playing. And so the character in this particular song, as so many great country songs, isn't necessarily as autobiographical as some of the other songs on the record. But that sentiment and those lingering questions of what will I leave behind if and when I leave this world, and whenever that would be, that certainly was at the forefront of making the record and the songs that went on it.
Tell me about the band Had a Call. It had a big following.
It was an exciting time in life, that's for sure. It was my brother Fred and I did the songwriting and the singing, and played guitar and piano primarily, and Fred was the lead guitar player on that. Richard Burgess on bass, Scott McQuiston was on drums early on the first record, and Brian Baker on the second. We released two records, traveled all over the country.
How would you describe that sound as compared to what we just heard?
Well, it definitely was, there was a lot more wattage going on with Had a Call than what you just heard on that song. We were kind of a high octane, not that we wouldn't slow it down once in a while, but we were known as a very high octane, alternative country, roots rock kind of band.
And to be fair, some of your new songs are a bit faster than what I just played. So how did you get into music?
Well, I started at a very early age on piano. I was lucky enough in high school while taking piano lessons to have a piano teacher who did not, early on saw that I was a creator more perhaps than a classically trained type of pianist. And so she really helped. She threw the books out and said, write for me, compose, and let's come in and talk about what you've composed. And I think that had a lot to do with it. Fred, my older brother, who was in Had a Call with me, as I said, was a huge influence because he's 7 years older than me and was showing the way. And my dad was very into country music, and so that influenced it as well.
So it was a family thing.
It was. And from the get-go, my brothers and my mom and when my daddy's alive, they would laugh at how, tell the story when I was young, I would bounce on the edge of the bed playing air piano to Elton John records. So yeah, it was at a very early age that I was struck by the music bug.
How did you meet the people, I mean, other than your brother, of course, I know mm-hmm. how you met your brother, but how did you meet the other people who would end up being some of your most important collaborators? I mean, we just heard the voice of Casey Rausch on the song from your new album. The people we hear on this album you've put together, because even though it's a solo album, you do have collaborators.
It's an enormous cast, an incredibly talented cast. Part of what I wanted to do was take advantage of the fact that I knew so many truly fantastic musicians from my days with Had a Call and old friendships. And I called those in with Richards on the record. He plays on the entire record again. But Marco Pasqualini, who's just one of the great guitar players I've ever known. Casey, Chad Boydston on trumpet, Bart Colliver on B3. These are all either old friends of mine or they're people that I've met through those friendships that I reached out. And I wanted a big sound and a diverse sound on the record. So luckily a lot of enthusiastic support from some really fantastic musicians.
So you have taken a significant amount of time off from being in a band and releasing albums and stuff like that. What inspired you to get back into it?
I was on a walk with my wife a couple of years ago, and she asked kind of a strange question, but she said, if you were to die tomorrow, is there anything you haven't done that you would regret? And I thought about it for a
light
second.
Like conversation for
yeah,
a walk?
Yeah, and it's funny because we mentioned this the other day. I mentioned it to her, and she said, I really don't remember asking you that. So she doesn't even remember the situation. But I told her the only thing that I would really regret is never having recorded a solo record. And it was kind of quiet for a second, and she said, well, you need to get into the studio then. So she really supported it, as she always has, supported me with the music. And once I went in, I had recorded just recently, the only time I'd been in the studio was recording a children's song for Christy Strimmel, who co-produced the record. And I contributed a song she asked me to do, Elsie's Lullaby, which actually is the last song on the record. But she asked for a contribution to a children's project she was working on. So that got me back into the studio out with her, and I had so much fun working with Christy that I think that was part of what had me thinking about making a record. And then it really became, once I decided I was going to make the record, it really became a desire to leave something for my children.
So that first song that inspired you to take music up again a little more fully was a song that you wrote for your daughter, as you've said, that is on the new album. It's called Elsie's Lullaby. I'm guessing that's your daughter's name?
Yeah, it is. That's my oldest daughter, yes.
So why don't we listen to it and then we'll talk about it a little more. This is Elsie's Lullaby by Greg Wickham from the album Almost to Springfield.
Strangers talk loud, but don't speak the truth. Faith don't come easy when the darkness slips through. Trouble lays low, just a wet hand for you. And falling apart ain't a hard thing to do. Sleep, angel, sleep beneath the blue sky. Dream, baby, dream with your eyes open wide. Think for yourself, then go. Comes to those who let God do the rest.
What was it you were trying to communicate to your daughter with that song when you wrote it?
Well, I really just wanted to leave some fatherly words of wisdom. I wrote that. She's 9 now, but I wrote that song when she was a baby. And I think a lot of what infused the perspective on the entire record was being almost 40 years old before I had my first child. So I got a late start on it, and I think that offered a different perspective in terms of mortality. And so I really consciously wanted to leave some words of wisdom, and the main thing I wanted to get across really is there in the chorus. Think for yourself, do your best, and then let it go. You've just got to let it go.
So the idea being that by the time she's ready to hear words of wisdom from you, you might not be in a position to have that conversation?
That's exactly right. The first song on the record is one for my second daughter called Angel of Mercy, and it has a similar goal in mind, which is to write a song that both works in the present, and they both love those songs and identify them as their songs, but I don't think they grasped the full meaning of what I'm trying to say, and won't until much later in life and perhaps until after I'm gone. So it's, as a writer, it's trying to serve two different purposes there.
There are some references in that song to God. Are you religious?
I am. I'm spiritual. I would not say that I am. I don't wear it on my sleeve, perhaps, as strongly as some do. And I can't say that I'm someone who is attending church every Sunday and those things. But certainly, yeah, I am a spiritual person.
Fatherhood and spirituality, I mean, as some of the things that come up on this album, they aren't exactly sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know what I mean? I mean, do you find these themes to be a tough sell with the music crowd or no?
Well, it's been really interesting that, you know, when I went in to create this record, I wasn't even remotely concerned about the music crowd. And
because your audience is your children.
That's true. It really is. And to a large extent, myself, I really wanted to make a record that I was proud of and would enjoy, and then let the chips fall where they may. So I don't feel like the record is overtly religious. It certainly isn't intended to be. And in fact, it really, I think it's mainly that song that could create the vibe that it is. Spirituality and religion are two different things to me. So I don't think spirituality is a difficult sell. There are times when religion in the musical crowd, hardcore religion, can be a difficult sell, and understandably so, quite frankly.
As you sat down to write Words of Wisdom set to music for your children, who were small when you got started, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, the oldest was a baby at first. Did you find yourself surprised to realize what those words of wisdom would be?
That's an interesting question. And yeah, I would say probably so. Songwriting is in and of itself somewhat of a spiritual experience, in the fact that there's a certain magic to it. And I can't say that I sat down and said, here are the words of wisdom I want to get across to my daughters. Now let's write a song that has that. They just came out of me. Both of those songs, and I've since written one for my two-year-old son as well. I had to wait for it to happen. My daughters were kept on me saying, you've got to write one for Hank. You've got to write one for Hank. And I said, they happen when they happen. And so it wasn't overtly words of wisdom I was trying to get across. It just came out. And so you're almost a spectator. You look back at it and go, well, that's what was welling up inside of me at the time creatively. But those songs are very autobiographical, there's no doubt. And then the goal as a songwriter is, how do you write a song that is so intensely personal but is still accessible to others with their own points of view, their own experiences, their own perspectives? I did not want to write a record or create a record that had no audience, but I didn't want commercial success to have really any aspect to the creative process. So
when you talk about words of wisdom, and I mean, I think as a parent, I have a very, very young child at home, and I think you picture situations in their life. I mean, especially when they're tiny and they're not talking yet, and they're not, and you can't even imagine all of the situations that are going to come up in this person's life. You have no idea. And I think that giving advice at that point, in a way, is almost, it's a really beautiful thing to do, because it's not situational. It's just unconditional. Is there a piece of advice that came up in one of those songs that you found touching, just to discover it yourself?
Well, I don't know about advice. I will say that there's a moment in, for instance, in Elsie's Lullaby, where the music gets very quiet and it says, know that I'll love you even when I'm not here. And the emotion that's attached to that line, more than the advice, is very strong. I have a difficult time singing that when she's in the room without tearing up, because the emotion is so, the love is so unconditional. And ultimately, for all the advice that I am trying to leave, and again, that's only on a couple songs of the whole record. There's a lot of different things going on. There are other personal moments as well. But it's ultimately the unconditional love for my children that I would want them to get out of the songs more than anything else.
As you brought other people into the project, was that hard to do given how personal this is, both for yourself? I mean, you've really been thinking about your own mortality.
It's been an interesting experience. Mortality has been on my mind probably ever since my dad died over 20 years ago. So it's a part of life. But no, the musicians are such great musicians, and I have such a personal connection to them that they seem to tap into that same vibe with me.
Well, our time is up. Greg Wickham, formerly of Had a Call, it's been so fun talking to you.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Greg's new album is called Almost to Springfield. You can listen back to our conversation with Greg or our mini clown convention from earlier in the show at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have that ready for you later today. Tomorrow, hear about a new discovery that has people asking about an ancient Indian city in Kansas. What it can tell us about the long-lost history of our region. Tomorrow on KCUR's Central Standard. That's it for today, but our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date. That's next.